Audio from the book, In Search of the Dead, Jeffrey Iverson. Published 1992, BBC Books. Word mistakes may be, then similarly reading wrong or errors. Introduction. There is more evidence for life after death than is generally realized. Carefully pieced together over many years by individual scientists, it has led some to believe that a new science of mind is necessary, if we are to understand the nature of our consciousness and how we fit into a universe, whose ultimate reality is still a mystery. The majority of scientists are skeptical about such claims, but in most cases they have not studied the evidence. Classical science preserves the blinkered neutrality it adopted 300 years ago, when the founding fathers, Messrs. Galileo, Descartes and Newton, decreed that science should analyze objective realities only. Subjective studies, like consciousness, were non-scientific and beyond the pale. Since then, the powerful probes of science have been generally pointed away from our interior selves, but nowadays parapsychologists and others say it's time for a change, for the boundaries to be redrawn. In the words of the British consultant neuropsychiatrist Dr. Peter Fenwick, the old science describes brain only in terms of structure and function. We know about the red wavelength of light but have no science to tell us why we see redness. We need a science of subjective experience because today's science explains only half the truth about our nature. We need a science of mind. Comment, and that spiritual science has already been born on Earth. It began by the cosmic science through the Danish Martinus, and his initiation in 1921. Runes remark, a subjective science of mind would be a scientific revolution, made possible in part by the disarray of traditional physics. Newton's idea of the universe as a great machine, obeying precise cause and effect rules, like balls on a billiards table, was shown to be inadequate almost a century ago by Albert Einstein's theory of relativity. Also, the true nature of matter is no longer perceived as particles, playing by these same rules of billiards, but as fields of energy which seem to behave in outrageous ways. Quantum physics has shown, on the smallest scale, that matter appears able to be in two places at the same time, and sometimes the experimenter, by his presence, seems to affect the outcome of his own experiments. Science seeks an overall theory to make sense of all this, and Newton definitely no longer has all the answers. The universe is a place of infinite mystery. One speculation is that the universe might be composed of thought, which could explain how an observer might appear to interact with his experiment. If matter is a frozen thought in a universe composed of mind stuff, then almost anything is possible, including the paranormal, survival of the mind after death, and all the as yet imperfectly understood phenomena mentioned in this book. For many years the theories of the world's leading physicists have sounded strangely like old-fashioned mysticism. The notion that reality might be thought is quite similar to the Buddhist concept of the world as a place of karmic illusion. A Nobel Prize winner for physics, Professor Brian Josephson, talked to me about these new possibilities. In the last decade, there has been a lot of talk about connections between science and mysticism. The reaction of a vast number of scientists has been that this is nonsense, it's pseudoscience. I think this is a wrong conclusion and we will in future see this kind of thing becoming routine science. A statement often made is that when something unorthodox comes up, scientists first ignore it, and then say it's nonsense. Eventually, they say it's obvious and was obvious all the time. I think we'll get that happening in the areas you are exploring. There are all sorts of things scientists claim which are really acts of faith, as much as any religious belief. When a scientist says we understand how the brain works, or how man came into existence through natural selection, these are enormous extrapolations. The sort of thing that happens is somebody writes a computer program which can understand simple sentences and says, we now understand the principle of language and how our minds work. Or somebody else produces a theory, which explains a little piece of evolution, like changes in the color of a moth as the background changes, and scientists say, we understand how evolution works. A new, subjective science of mind might seem a heresy to some, but they should reflect that the classical demarcation lines of science might have been much more soft-edged from the outset if Galileo and Descartes had not lived with the Holy Inquisition looking over their shoulders. Seekers after truth in the 17th century, who dared to advocate the study of man's inner thoughts, might quickly have been hauled off to a heresy trial and burned at the stake. Galileo came close to the flames simply by looking through his telescope at the movement of planets around the sun. His objective observation that the Earth circled the sun had the subjective implication that man's home planet was not at the center of God's universe. In those intolerant times, subjective science was out of the question, even had they wished it. Let's help it's not the same today. Before examining the evidence for life after death, there was an obvious preliminary question: is there any scientific sign of some quality or force within us, which might be capable of surviving death of the body? Science teaches that our body is a machine made of meat, our brain a sort of computer. Everything vanishes without trace at death, or is there some alternative explanation? In the first part of this book, we scrutinize the evidence that there might be more to us than this, there might be mind as well as brain. Dr. Fenwick defined the rules of this classical scientific debate: to talk about mind and brain being different, you have to show mind can exist on its own, is able to pass on information without the use of brain's five senses. You have to put someone in a box, seal them up so they can't get information, and somehow information is then transmitted to them by none of the known physical causes. That's a good description of remote viewing, a type of experiment parapsychologists have been doing for years. We filmed a remarkably successful remote viewing test, where a person, shut away in a sealed room in New York, visualized a scene someone else was telepathically trying to transmit. She described and drew on paper a secret location in the city as precisely as if she had been standing on the same spot as the observer. This was done by the power of psi, the modern name for telepathy or extrasensory perception, still sometimes known as ESP. The existence of psi has been demonstrated statistically by parapsychologists who have analyzed hundreds of tests at scientific institutes in various parts of the United States. For psi in the community, we looked at the psychics who from time to time help police investigate serious crimes such as murder. The book reveals the remarkable, untold story of a Canadian psychic working on the manhunt for the murderer known as Son of Sam back in the 1970s. A parapsychologist, Dr. Carlos Sozis, and a New York detective supervised a team of psychics trying to pinpoint the killer. Evidence which seemed directly to support the idea of survival came from people revived from apparent death by the techniques of modern medicine. Millions of people have had near-death experiences. Usually they claim to leave their bodies, float through a black tunnel and enter a world of brilliant light. Dr. Melvin Morse of Seattle has studied near-death experiences in children and has a collection of wonderful color drawings of the next world, made by youngsters close to death. Dr. Morse is critical of scientific explanations that near-death experiences are either hallucinations in a dying brain or a reliving of the birth experience. He seemed to find support in the case of a woman, suffering a heart attack, who found herself floating around outside the hospital, where she noticed a tennis shoe on a distant window ledge. Her out-of-body experience might have been written off as hallucination if a hospital social worker had not recovered the shoe from the ledge. Scientists have done surveys of apparitions, which appear at times of crisis, sometimes to give a warning. A newly discovered case was on board a British warship in the Second World War, where there was an invisible presence in an operations room and a voice that warned of approaching enemy aircraft. Apparitions sometimes manifest themselves to the dying. Scientists have questioned doctors and nurses in the United States and India about the experiences of dying patients. Shortly before death, many patients claim to have a visitor, a dead friend or relative who comes to take them away to the next world. Most go willingly. Much good evidence for survival comes from a lifetime's work by Professor Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia. He has done 30 years of research into reincarnation cases and has files of 2,500 children who claim to remember previous lives. Stevenson always considers alternatives, like fraud and hallucination, before making a judgment. He has a nucleus of about 25 cases where reincarnation clearly seems the likeliest explanation, and told me, science should pay a lot more attention to the evidence we have pointing towards life after death. Looked at fairly, the evidence is impressive and from a variety of sources. The prevailing orthodoxy is when your brain dies, your mind perishes also. That is so deeply believed that scientists fail to understand it as an assumption only, and there is no reason why aspects of the mind should not survive death of the brain. But to shake this belief amongst scientists of today is extremely difficult. Stevenson hopes to make an impact on this entrenched belief with publication of 4 volumes of a major scientific work, A Study of Birthmarks and Birth Defects in Children Who Remember Other Lives. His new evidence is compelling. Children who remember living before sometimes carry marks and deformities suffered in a previous life. In India, a boy with no fingers on his right hand remembered a life as a child whose fingers on the right hand were cut off in a fodder chopping machine. Another child hanged twice. It seems the first execution was bungled and the murderer's jaw was smashed in the process. In many of the cases, Stevenson has documents and photographs confirming the injuries suffered in previous lives. These young children sometimes start talking about another life with almost the first words they speak. And for Stevenson, this is significant. Infants are unlikely to be able to concoct a story about another life from something they previously had heard or read about. This is a problem with all such adult memories, including hypnotic regressions. In some of the cases examined, particularly of children, their precise identity has not been revealed, usually at the request of the family. One aim of this book is to interest non-scientists in the somewhat neglected and malign work of parapsychologists. Some have published studies of their own cases, and these are listed at the back of this book. The evidence they have uncovered is startling and of value to non-scientists and scientists alike. It should cause us all to pause and think more deeply, and optimistically, about what we truly are and what may be our destiny. With television colleagues from Britain and the United States, I followed the trail of the parapsychologists across the continents of Europe, America and Asia. It was an enlightening journey in search of the dead. Chapter 1 Powers of the Mind. Nowadays, most people identify themselves almost exclusively with their consciousness and imagine they are only what they know about themselves. Yet anyone with even a smattering of psychology can see how limited this knowledge is. Rationalism and doctrinarism are the diseases of our time. They pretend to have all the answers. But a great deal will yet be discovered which our present limited view would have ruled out as impossible. Carl Jung. Chapter 1. A Green Man with Wings. Man also possesses a power by which he may see his friends and the circumstances by which they are surrounded, although such persons may be 1,000 miles away from him at that time. Paracelsus. 16th century German philosopher. Is the truly some power of the mind, some inner eye, which allows people to see what is happening miles away from them? In September 1990, we recorded a remote viewing experiment in New York, which suggested that people do have such an ability. In a tightly controlled scientific test, a stranger in New York somehow managed to beam in on Dr. Nancy Sondo, an American psychologist, at a secret location in the vast city. She described telepathically what Dr. Sondo was looking at, including something very individual, a statue of a large green angel with wings, which Dr. Sondo happened to be standing in front of. The scientists running the experiment were delighted, but said they would need to run more tests before they could scientifically say the subject had proven psi ability. They were not particularly startled because they have seen similar results before and know from the statistics of many trials that remote viewing really works. Together we had recorded a spectacularly successful experiment, but a hit, even an absolute bull's eye, does not in itself prove the existence of the paranormal to scientists concerned chiefly with the statistical average of many tests. The most surprised person was the subject of the experiment, Tessa Caudle, my production assistant. In a library miles from the target site, with all of New York City and Manhattan to choose from, Tessa saw a typically English park dominated by a statue of a man with wings, an angel made of metal which was turning green. She drew pictures of this figure and other very specific aspects of the scene, all of which were found to exist at the secret location. It was a success that would have impressed a hardened cynic. Tessa, who is from Wales, had not previously regarded herself as psychic, but the scientists were keen to have an independent subject, a stranger provided by our team of outsiders. The scientists believe that remote viewing can be done by anyone, and someone to whom New York was entirely unknown made the experiment even more convincing. As to the filming, we recorded the full scientific experiment as it happened. There were no shortcuts for television. The assessment of the remote viewing test was done by Dr. Keith Harry, research director of the Institute for Advanced Psychology, San Francisco. He was unaware of the true location and compared Tessa's descriptions with four possible sites in New York, which he was told about after Tessa had recorded her test. With Tessa's drawing in one hand and notes of what she had said in the other, he had no difficulty in correctly identifying the target site, a small park next to a church. Only if the assessor gets it right does a remote viewing score scientifically as a hit. This prevents possible collusion or wishful thinking by the subject and the sender. It also means there is a straightforward 1 in 4 possibility that the judge may correctly select the target by chance alone. In this case, more impressive than the odds against Dr. Harry making a correct judgment, was Tessa's precise description of the target. She correctly described 5 different aspects of the scene, including a small building with a pointed roof and a row of small shops, one with a red and white striped awning, on the road which ran alongside the park. Just as remarkably, she drew the major features of the scene on a single sheet of paper. There were no drawings of elements not found at the location, nor did she make any spoken references to anything not present at the target site. It was just as if Tessa had been there in person, standing alongside Dr. Sondo. Also, the location was very different from any stereotyped image of a city famous for skyscrapers and hustle and bustle. That would have been Tessa's idea of New York, and yet, when she was afterwards taken to see the target site for the first and only time, she said, "This is incredible. This is the place I saw." Dr. Harry's verdict on her success was, "Results like this are why people are interested in this area. There is a lot to explain, a lot to study." We began the experiment at the headquarters of the American Society for Psychical Research, ASPR, on 73rd Street. Our volunteer was introduced to Dr. Harry, a small dynamo of a psychologist with much experience of psi experiments. The two sat quietly in the library and began some conditioning exercises, a preparation for what was to come. "I'm thinking of an object outside this room," said Harry. "Think of it. Draw its shape." Tessa drew what looked like a tennis ball, slightly flattened at the top and bottom. "Anything else about it?" asked Harry. Tessa drew an extension near the top. It now resembled a teapot with a spout but no handle. "Good," said Harry. "Let me show you what I was thinking of." On the wall outside the room was a round light fitting, a globe mounted on the wall by a bracket attached to its underside. It was like Tessa's spoutless teapot, but upside down. "Let's do another," said Harry. "Hold out your hand, I'm going to give you something." He placed his empty palm over Tessa's outstretched hand and said, "There's something in my hand. What does it feel like?" "It's soft. I'm going to turn it over." "What does the other side feel like?" "It's soft too." "What is it?" "It's a sponge." And so it was. In the kitchen, Harry showed Tessa a small sponge, used for washing dishes, which he'd put to one side. Those were the preliminaries. Now we were ready for the main event. We set up a locked-off camera in the library, loaded with a tape that ran for 20 minutes. With no one else in the room, it recorded everything the pair said and did during the experiment, which lasted 15 minutes. Elaborate precautions were taken to prevent any leakage of information to Tessa and Harry, shut away on the first floor. At 2:30 p.m., the psychologist Dr. Nancy Sondo gave me a copy of a list of four possible target sites she had drawn up with the acting director of the ASPR, Patrice Keane. This copy, unopened, remained in my wallet until the experiment was over. I stayed on the ground floor and never went near the library. Then Nancy Sondo left the ASPR to get a cab. She numbered the sites 1 to 4, and used a random number generator to select site 3. Tessa and Harry, isolated in the library, knew only that Nancy was going somewhere within half an hour's drive of the ASPR and would be on site by 3:15 p.m. No one inside the ASPR, not even Patrice Keane, knew exactly where Nancy had gone. At 3:15 p.m. Tessa began talking and drawing the things she felt she could see. Harry, prompted by asking simple questions such as, "What can you see?" At 3:30 p.m. the core of the experiment was finished. Tessa remained in the library to await Nancy Sondo's return. Harry joined me and the rest of the television crew on the ground floor. We drove to each site on the list in my wallet, going first to the nearest, an order worked out by our director, Jack Kelly, who was familiar with New York. At each of the four locations, Lincoln Center, Trump Towers in Manhattan, a boat dock, and the small park, Harry recorded his assessment of how they compared with Tessa's description. A few hours later, at the final location, Harry rated the sites in order of probability. The park was his clear choice. During the blind judging of the four sites, Harry's verdict on each went as follows. At Lincoln Center, a lively plaza dominated by a fountain. He said there's no statue. The buildings are fairly large, as opposed to the small structure Tessa saw. I don't see a T-shaped path here, but we have shops and an awning. There are lots of people here and she didn't see lots of people. She didn't have water and the thing she described did not look like this fountain. Not really a lot of tall trees either. I'm not powerfully gripped by this place, but it's got some subtle aspects. Let's go check on the other stuff. Site 2 was Trump Towers, a glass-fronted skyscraper reflecting the frenetic activity of a Manhattan main thoroughfare. I don't see any relationship to this drawing. It's very noisy, very crowded. It's not peaceful, that's for sure. I don't see any statues. It doesn't really fit. Site 3 gave us another change of mood. It was the water's edge at the 79th Street boat basin. We're in a park-like place, and it's quiet getting here. There's no statue here, and there was no water, nothing about boats, in her description. If this was the site and you were to look for correspondences with her description, they are not here. There are a lot of people around, and I would not be big on this as the likely site. Finally, we visited a small park dominated by a statue called Peace alongside the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. We came to it last by pure coincidence, and the impact on Harry was immediate. It's very hard to ignore having somebody describe a statue with wings, when you find a statue with wings. At the outset, at the ASPR, Harry gave Tessa these instructions. Take a deep breath, and just kind of relax. It's quite straightforward really. We'll take you to a place where you haven't been before and Nancy is the right now. So you can focus on Nancy and what she's experiencing, the sound and the smell. Just imagine yourself with her in a way, and yourself the later. The remote viewing in the library, Tessa, it's not noisy. It doesn't seem to be noisy, as if the noise is at a distance. A path, I think. Yes, a concrete path or a gravel path. Harry, you kind of look around. What surprises you about it? Tessa, that's quite peaceful considering it's surrounded by noise and traffic and goings on. Like tranquil. A small piece of quiet. Harry, you said there was a path.
Tessa, yes.
Harry, can you tell me anything about that path?
Tessa, I think it's like a T. I think it may be a path like that, draws a T-shaped path.
Tessa, I think there are tall trees there, but they're not close. If you look up you can see the branches coming over, but quite tall.
The assessment at the target site.
Harry, okay, the first thing I notice as I come up this path, that does come to a kind of T, there is a statue with wings. There is a cement or stone walk here and there are trees around and it is peaceful here. Very peaceful. It's the Statue of Peace. Tall trees are up above us because they're on higher ground.
Tessa, I don't know if there's a stand down one end, the far end of the path.
Maybe like a summer stand, bandstand or something white, with railings and a pointed roof. Looks at drawing. There is a structure like that right over there in the corner of that building, sort of with that pointy wooden roof. There is metal fencing, although not exactly the way she described it. There is another small structure over there that could also relate to this. It has steps going up.
Tessa, I think the roof is wooden and the railings are all metal and the steps are wooden.
Tessa, well it must be a park. It's sort of like where people go to eat their lunch, their sandwiches in the city. You could think your own thoughts there.
It does seem vaguely British or European.
It's like one of the small parks you might come across walking through central London.
Harry, what's
this is a park. Nancy doing here?
Tessa, enjoying the quiet I think.
It feels to me as if she's standing right here, draws a figure on the path.
Dot, she also described having the city sort of surrounding this park-like area.
Harry, look around, turn around in some new direction.
Tessa, I can see small shops off to the left-hand side.
Across, out of the park, but not that far away, there's like small delis, delicatessens, and one looks as if it's got a red and white striped canopy over it.
Just a little row of shops.
Sort of between the trees, but not that far away. I'm trying to stand where she is and look around, which is not easy. And then having shops across the street, and red and white striped awning, which I see the five a red and white striped awning. And this is definitely more red and white than the awning we saw at Lincoln Center.
This is really red and white.
Harry, it's also where you're going to be. You're going to be there.
Well, it's very hard to ignore having somebody describe a statue with wings and finding a statue with wings.
In fact, I would have to say the statue is a very prominent feature of the site.
It is a park, the statue is turning green, and she did mention the statue had green to it.
Look at those wings.
God, really striking.
Looks at drawing.
Here we have a picture of wings, this could be the head.
Obviously, this would have to be the first choice.
So we have the trees, the wings, the awning, the stores, the park-like setting, the statue, green on the statue, the sort of small T-shaped walk coming into this place.
I'm going to have to rate this number 1.
Lincoln Center would probably be number 2, the Boat Basin 3 and Trump Tower 4th. But this is a big number 1.
I mean this has so many correspondences that it will be interesting if this is not the place.
Tessa, there might be a statue, like a bronze or a metal with a concrete base.
It's either something with wings,
I don't know, like an angel or something.
It looks like a butterfly, points to her drawing.
It's not a butterfly, it's like something with wings and a long robe, where the metal turns a sort of green, greeny color. It could have been a man.
This is quite tall.
Harry, pointing to drawing of structure with pointed roof.
Is that the same general location?
Tessa, it could be directly in front of that.
I'm not really sure where that is.
It's somewhere there.
Harry, what do you think it's about?
Tessa, just a small park that was built when the residential area around it was built, as a recreational ground for the early century.
You don't feel closed in by the skyscrapers or any buildings there.
Just a plane going across the sky.
It's quite unobstructed.
Harry, you've never been here before.
Tessa, number Harry.
Good.
Tessa, are there any people around?
A couple walking dogs, but not a lot of people. After the judging, Jack Kelly telephoned Dr. Sondo at the ASPR to ask where we should meet. She said the park was the target site. Only then were we sure the experiment had been successful.